This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation, available at podcast.lannan.org. William Gass with Micheline Aharonian-Markholm, recorded in Santa Fe on September 22, 2004. William Gass, one of the elder statesmen of American letters, is a writer of complex and experimental novels, a cultural essayist, a philosopher, and a teacher. Here he reads a new essay, Don't Look Back, before having a conversation about his work with the young novelist, Micheline Aharonian-Markholm.
I wanted to come out, and I'll be very brief. I'd like to welcome you to yet another season. I can't believe the summer's over. And I think, at my age, my memory, the years are beginning to run together. I think this is our seventh season, and I really want to thank each and every one of you and all your friends and acquaintances and all the people in Santa Fe for the support. We're going to continue to do this as long as people want to come and enjoy it. So. I also would just want to mention that KSFR, our local public radio station, seems to be doing better and better every year, will be carrying this live from 2 to 3:30 on Sunday, and they'll continue to do that during the whole season. So if anybody misses an event, they can listen on Sunday afternoon. I'll briefly introduce Micheline Aharonian-Markholm, a wonderful young novelist. She was born in Saudi Arabia and raised in Los Angeles. If those of you who read the program know this, but she's the author of two very distinguished novels. Her first one, Three Apples Fell from Heaven, was published in 2001 by Riverhead Books, as was her second novel. And it's set in Turkey between 1915 and 1917, and it depicts the Ottoman government's epic genocide, the real beginning of the 20th century, I guess, in a dark way. It was named one of the best books of 2001 by both the Los Angeles Times and the New York Times. It was also the runner-up for the Hemingway Pen Award for First Fiction. It's a wonderful book, and it's available, and it's probably for sale out there at the bookstand. Her most recent novel, The Daydreaming Boy, came out this past spring. It's about a haunted middle-aged survivor of this Armenian massacre who was living in Beirut in 1960s. It's a very interesting book. This is a planned trilogy, so I'm not sure when the third book's coming out. Micheline is currently a visiting writer and professor at Mills College in Oakland, California. And she was last here, many of you were probably here, when she interviewed Tariq Ali. So please join me in welcoming Micheline Markholm. Thank you.
Good evening. Thank you, Patrick, and thank you to the Lannan Foundation for, again, inviting me back. It is an incredible honor and privilege and pleasure to introduce to you William H. Gass. And I just wanted to tell you how I first heard about his work. I was actually standing in the hallway of the college I work at, and I was chatting with another writer and, you know, complaining, kvetching, actually, about the state of American letters and the commercial interests which so dominate the publishing industry. And so he asked me if I'd read William Gass, and then suggested I begin with a book of his essays entitled Finding a Form. And that book, Finding a Form, and finding Mr. Gass's work for me, the essays first and then later his fiction, was a boon. It was an amazing, one of those moments when you find these books that you feel like they sort of save you a little bit. These texts in a world, in an industry that is so dominated by lies or half-lies and is so riddled with mediocrity, which is then hailed as, of course, the next best thing. In his work, I found what I'm always seeking in books, in art, and honesty, I think, integrity and beauty also. The novel taken to some kind of edge, the possibilities of the form of sentences and what they can make and how they can sing. And the importance of art, of letters, despite so much evidence to the contrary, and perhaps even more so because of the times we're living in right now. For the despairing writer, this is on occasion important to remember and to be told and retold and shown its power, illuminations, the word, which does make things, makes a freedom of the mind and contains being. So Mr. Gass was born in Fargo, North Dakota in 1924. He earned a doctorate in philosophy from Cornell University in 1954. He taught for over 30 years at Washington University in St. Louis, where he was also the director and I think founder of the International Writers Center. He's written 5 books of fiction, including what many consider to be his magnum opus, The Tunnel, a book that was 26 or 27 years in the making, he told me, and what many critics have hailed as a masterpiece. Michael Silverblatt, writing for the Los Angeles Times, called it, quote, the most beautiful, most complex, most disturbing novel to be published in my lifetime. Mr. Gass has published numerous collections of essays, which he's twice won the National Book Critics Circle Award for. And I would just like to leave you with some of his words, if I may, from an essay entitled The Artist and Society. Art does tell us, in its manner, how to live. We live, most of us, amidst lies, deceits, and confusions. A work of art may not utter the truth, but it must be honest. Naturally, the artist is an enemy of the state. He cannot play politics, succumb to slogans and other simplifications, worship heroes, ally himself with any party, suck on some politician's program like a sweet. He undermines everything. The artist's revolutionary activity is of a different kind. He is concerned with consciousness, and he makes his changes there. An uncorrupted consciousness, what a dangerous thing it is. I give you Mr. William Gass.
Thank you very much, and it's always, of course, a great pleasure and an honor to be here at the Lannan. And I am indebted to Patrick Lannan for many, many things that I won't cause him to blush by mentioning even. But he has, of course, helped so many writers, and, of course, all of them worth it. Don't look back, Satchel Paige is supposed to have said. Someone may be gaining on you. Don't look back, Orpheus was advised. You may find your earlier poems better than the ones you will write tomorrow. Lot's wife looked back at Sodom and was so shaken by the sight of the Red Sea swallowing the city, she became salt. Look back only if the mess you have made of your life leaves you eager to reach a future which will offer a fairer prospect. Otherwise, cover your eyes before blame blinds them. However, Paul Valéry warns us that no one, quote, can deliberately walk away from any object without casting a backward glance to make sure he is walking away from it. At 80 years, only the past is likely to have any length. Greed and regret will have eaten the present, which is at best a sliver of cake too small for its plate, while the future fears it may cease before having been. I hear it running to get here, its labored breathing like an old man on the stairs. Lust and rage, Yeats rightly said, attend one's old age. So it is in a spirit of disobedience that I look back at what I may have done rather than toward all that remains to be encountered, coped with, perhaps yet accomplished. I say may have done, because what one has really done is never clear and certainly never comforting. Rarely does one say, I may have married her, but only time will tell. Your station in the literary world, whatever that might be, does not matter much if you spent your life chasing words with Nabokov's net. That's still where your life went, into the killing jar. Results of the chase pinned between boards like any lepidoptera, sentenced to a verbal situation and chloroformed in place, first a cause of indifference and then evermore ignored. Looking back, it is less painful to concentrate on the kind of thing that concerned me rather than on the messes I made or on the few imaginary triumphs I may have enjoyed. Looking back, I find I fit the epitaph Howard Nemiroff once wrote for himself in Gnomes and Occasions. Of the great world, he knew not much, but his muse let little in language escape her. Friends sigh and say of him, poor wretch, he was a good writer on paper. It turns out that these preoccupations, these bad habits, these quirks, number at least 8, though I'm sure I'm ignoring the ones that really matter. They are naming, metaphoring, jingling, preaching, theorizing, celebrating, indicting, translating. So first, naming. Critics still write of me as if my interest in words was an aberration. Yet Adam's task has always seemed to me to be, for a writer, the central one, to name, and in that way, to know. It wasn't true for Adam, for whom all names were fresher than the daisy, but it is true for us now. A name no longer merely points something out and distinguishes it in that manner from the rest of the world. Every name stands for all that has been thought, felt, said, perceived, and imagined about its referent, and represents all that has been discovered during explorations of its indigenous concepts during 2,000 years. And since we humans have the deplorable yet entrancing habit of naming things that do not exist, the realm of names is larger than the realm of things, as much as the population of China exceeds that of Santa Fe. Now, this passage about naming trees comes from my first novel, Omen Setter's Luck, and concerns my unfortunate character, Henry Pimber, who will end up hanging himself from one of the branches of the trees he sings about. The path took Henry Pimber past the slag across the meadow creek, where his only hornbeam hardened slowly in the southern shadow of the ridge, and the trees of the separating wood began in rows as the lean road in his dream began, narrowing to nothing in the blank horizon, for train rails narrow behind anybody's journey. And he named them as he passed them, elm, oak, hazel, larch, and chestnut tree, as though he might have been the fallen Adam passing them and calling out their soft, familiar names, as though familiar names might make some friends for him by being spoken to the unfamiliar and unfriendly world which he was told had been his paradise. In God's name, when was that? When had that been? For he had hated every day he'd lived, ash, birch, maple, every day he thought would last forever, and the night forever, and the dawn drag eternally another long and empty day to light forever. Yet they sped away, the day, the night clicked past as he walked by the creek by the hornbeam tree, the elders, sorrels, cedars, and the fir. For as he named them, sounding their soft names in his lonely skull, the fire of fall was on them, and he named the days he'd lost. It was still sorrowful to die, eternity for them had ended. And he would fall when it came his time, like an unseen leaf, the bud that was the glory of his birth forgot before remembered. He named the aspen, beech, and willow, and he said aloud the locust when he saw it leafless like a battlefield. In God's name, when was that? When had that been? I've never been able to break the denominating habit. In a recent piece, Emma enters a line of Elizabeth Bishop's, I managed to cram the names of 110 weeds into one paragraph. Writing has almost always been difficult for me, something I had to do to remain sane, yet never satisfying in any ordinary sense, certainly never exhilarating, and never an activity that might satisfy Socrates' admonition to find a logos for my life, as I felt it surely had for the authors I admired, even Malcolm Lowry's dissolutely drunken sprees, even Hart Crane's beatings at the hands of sailors, beatings he sought out as he ultimately sought the sea, even Céline's meanness, a bitterness that ate through his heart before it got to his shoes, and ate them too. Even these malcontents, though nothing justified their wasted ways, their anger, their multiplication of pain, might be by their works somewhat saved, their sins hidden under sublime blots of printer's ink. Number two, whoring and metaphoring. One aspect of writing was easy, was unstoppable, and that was the flow of imagery that ran through my head like a creek in flood. No, like Mauna Loa lava, but not that hot. No, like New York marathoners without the heavy breathing. No, like fire ants or killer bees who were a little lazy, not so pushy or so mean. No, no, no. I could swat away six and still write eight. It was a curse disguised as a blessing. I was always looking at the world from another word. The wolf spider roams at night from field to field in search of prey, while a mantis sits still as a twig by a flower's sweetened cup until some sucker comes to nose it. And then she, the Madam Mantis, sups. But these facts interested me mainly because I knew people like that. I was one, a waiter, the sort of waiter who is always looking the other way. So I wanted, when I named a tree, to invoke a plant equal to every phase the plant had seen. I didn't simply want to make a tree with roots, bark, branches, trunk, twigs, nesting birds, needles, and leaves. I wanted to imagine ones that were telepoles, too, bore lynch limbs, and had branches to which possums were driven by packs of unpleasant dogs. I wanted trees with doors in them, closed trees where dress suits were hung, trees that had family histories dangling from their diagrams. I am not observant of persons, so if I imagine someone whose skin is as smooth and pale as a grocery mushroom, it is the mushroom that did it. Among the thousands of my photographs, there may be three, a fairy tale number, that misinclude people, and even then, they look like barely promising piles of rags. Recently, in an essay on Francois Rabelais, I wrote that while his work looked woolly, its sense was consistent, unified, pure, yet iridescent as though silk had swallowed water. That last image was a simple pun on watered silk that let me gloat a quarter of an hour before its time on the meter was up. I'm 80 now and should know better, but I recently let a sentence reach print so embarrassingly bad, its metaphors seemed frightened into scattered flight like quail. I meant to shame myself, by reciting it to you, but I find I cannot, sparing myself, not you. Instead, I'll quote something that's perhaps passable from a story called Order of Insects in the collection In the Heart of the Heart of the Country. For this piece, I did indeed study cockroaches and came to admire them immensely. Few humans measure up, haven't the humility, the wiles, the longevity, or body armor, the moves. But it was as a metaphor made into a symbol that I wanted to use them. A housewife who narrates the story has begun finding dead roaches on her downstairs carpet in the morning, apparently killed by her murderously playful cat. As she inspects them, she finds a beauty in their construction that imperils her opinion of her own life. She wonders what would happen if we wore our skeletons on the outside like a costume for Halloween, and concludes this way. I suspect that if we were as familiar with our bones as with our skin, we'd never bury dead, but shrine them in their rooms, arranged as we might like to find them on a visit. And our enemies, if we could steal their bodies from the battle sites, would be museumed as they died, the steel still eloquent in their sides, their metal hats askew, the protective toes of their shoes unworn. And friend and enemy would be so wondrously historical that in 100 years we'd find the jaws still hung for the same speech, and all the parts we spent our life with, tilted as they always were, rib cage, collar, skull, still repetitious, defiant, angel light, still worthy of memorial and affection. After all, what does it mean to say that when our cat has bitten through the shell and put confusion in the pulp, the life goes out of them? Alas for us, I want to cry, our bones are secret, showing last, so we must love what perishes, the muscles and the waters and the fats. Number 3, jingling. When you're a cowed and confused kid, you say to the stupid question grown-ups always ask with such condescension that you want to bruise their shins, I hope to be a fireman when I grow up. But of course, you really want to be a poet. Everyone wants to be a poet. It is the peak. How many poets have told us? At 12, I wrote awful Edgar Allan Poe, much as Poe had. Jingle all the way. At 14, I was as interminable as Walt Whitman. I extolled the groceries and made lists of buffalo hunters and Indian scouts. I did patriotism, I'm ashamed to say, and praised mothers. My God, I was even against drink. Most of all, what I wrote was bad. Not just youthful. Not just undisciplined, bad beyond excuse. After years of futile wondering, I think I now know why. My irreverence, my hatred for authority, my distrust of tradition, my enjoyment of the comforts of middle-class life, and my contempt for its Philistine values, my habitual up-yours and in-your-eye attitude, also inhibited my ability to absorb conventional poetic forms. Instead, I was attracted to the urchins among them, indecorous lines and unruly stanzas. Ezra Pound, an early hero, too melodious and poetical by half much of the time, would nevertheless burst out to my delight with, "Damn it all this our South stinks piece." A sestina in praise of bloodshed and war. While at other times, condemn such belligerence as he does in Hugh Selwyn Moberly's unforgiving anger at the First World War. There died a myriad, and of the best among them, for an old bitch gone in the teeth, for a botched civilization. Or when, in the same poem, he wrote that his true Penelope was Flaubert, I was immediately moved because Flaubert has always been my favorite hater. And I was grateful to Pound too, though absurdly, because he was the first poet I knew to use the word fucking in a poem, even if they were panthers that were up to it. I despised pop tunes, yet I imbibed their forms. When Gertrude Stein wrote, "My name is Rose, my eyes are blue, my name is Rose, and who are you? My name is Rose, and when I sing, I am Rose like anything," I was perhaps more pleased than was reasonable. I practiced the limerick in secret and dallied with other cheapjack devices. My career as a poet ended in doggerel and japery. Yet I found a use to which I might put them, these dogs. For my novel, The Tunnel, I invented an historian named Culp, whose subject, I meanly said, was the American Indian. And I claimed that he was energetically engaged in writing a limerical history of the world, as well as a cycle of such rhymes that shared the same first line, namely, "I once went to bed with a nun." And I got good at it, at the limerick, I mean, and began to do to it what I couldn't do to the sonnet, namely torture its type. And here are three from the Carthaginian period. "Over the Alps on an elephant went Hannibal out of his element, for the elephant's motion was so like the ocean, he continually punicked upon his best tunics, and his slaves had to wash off the elephant." Earlier, Dido wrote to Aeneas, "Why don't you sail by and see us? I'm here all alone with my lust and no phone, half dead of desire, my crotch quite on fire, which I've heard you'd put out with your penis." Later yet, Dido said to Aeneas, "Surely you're not going to leave us. You wouldn't flee home just to found Rome, which will fall anyway, so you might as well stay to enjoy all my sweet panaceas." Some nuns. "I once went to bed with a nun by pointing a pistol at one. Said she with a quaver, 'That's a good big persuader, but what's the point of the gun?'" Lastly, my favorite, a nun went to bed with the Pope, who tied her four limbs with a rope. "It's not that, my dear, you have something to fear, but I want you quite still, so nothing will spill when your holiness is filled by the Pope." A segue to number four, preaching. I have been characterized as and accused of, sentenced to, sentences. Well, it's easier to study the sentence than the story, and you do have to write a lot of sentences if you want to pretend to write prose. But I have always been equally interested in paragraphs. I like, for light reading, texts on rhetoric, not just those of Aristotle, Cicero, and Quintilian, but also those of George Campbell, Richard Whately, Joseph Priestley, Hugh Blair, and Thomas De Quincey. In such works, and only in them, is the question of the form of the paragraph, as well as the shape of the phrase addressed, and the lost art of eloquence taken seriously. Any plowboy can become a father, Mencken famously remarked, and, quote, "Every man, as he walks through the streets, may contrive to jot down an independent thought, a shorthand memorandum of great truth," De Quincey says. "Standing on one leg, you may accomplish this. The labor of composition begins when you have to put your separate threads of thought into a loom, to weave them into a continuous whole, to connect, to introduce them, to blow them out or expand them, to carry them to a close," unquote. just as De Quincey carries his own paragraph to a close by carrying it to the word close. So I've tended, when conceiving characters, to prefer fulminators, preachers and teachers, and allowed them to consider the misfortune, more important to me than any other apparently, that of missing the opportunities and obligations offered you by the luck of having life. Here is one such preacher, Jethro Ferber, speaking to his rural Ohio congregation in Omansetter's Luck. I ask you now to ask yourselves one simple, foolish question, to say, was I born for this? And I ask you to please face it honestly and answer yea if you can, or nay if you must. For this, you rise in the morning, you stretch, you scratch your chest. For this, all night while you snored, the moon burned as it burned for Jesus or for Caesar. You wash, you dress. For this, at breakfast there are pancakes with dollops of butter and you drip syrup on your vest. So it's for this. You lick your lips. Ah, then it's this. You slide your pants to your knees and you grunt in the jakes. It's for this. Lights leaving a star while you stare at the weeds. Centipedes live in the cracks of the floor. And the sun, the Lord says, shines on good and evil equally. So you were meant for this? You've your eyes, your human consciousness, for this? Well, you're certainly not easy in your mind. The weather's been poor. There are the crops to get in, payments to make on the farm, ailing calves to tend. Friends have promised to help with the haying, but they haven't. And you've got to keep your eldest son somehow away from that bargeman's daughter, a bitch with cow's tits. The mind's for this? Wipe yourself now. Hang your pants from your shoulders. There are glaciers growing. But you wish your wife weren't so fat and given to malice, and your thoughts are angry and troubled by this. This? Very well, you can complain that I've chosen trivialities in order to embarrass you. Eat, sleep, love, dress. Of course, you were born for something better than this. I carry this refrain on into The Tunnel, a novel finished some 30 years later, where it turns out that men were made to murder one another and to invent the bulldozer in order to dig mass graves. Along with hundreds of others, I was once asked by a French newspaper to state in a word why I wrote. I replied in a sentence suitable for a courtroom, "I write to indict mankind." I suppose I could have said, "I write to convict mankind," but man has already done that without my help, and beside, I wanted the use of the pun. So, on to number 5, indicting. This is my account, the bald facts taken from Holocaust documents, of the death pit at Dubno, and my narrator of The Tunnel's characteristic double-edged use of it. We read, "And therefore see before us a great mound of earth which bulldozers have gouged from the ground. In front of the mound, a mile of naked strangers. In groups of 20, like smokes, they are directed to the other side by a man with a truncheon and a whip. It will not help to ink in his face. Several men with barrows collect clothes. There are young women still with attractive breasts. There are family groups, many small children crying quietly, tears oozing from their eyes like sweat. In whispers, people comfort one another. Soon, they say, soon. No one wails and no one begs. Arms mingle with other arms, like fallen limbs, lie like shawls across bony shoulders. A loose, gray calm descends. It will be soon. Soon. A grandmother coos at the infant she cuddles, her gray hair hiding all but the feet. The baby giggles when it's chucked. A father speaks earnestly to his son and points at the heavens where surely there is an explanation. It is doubtless their true destination. The color of the sky cannot be colored in. So the son is lied to right up to the last. Father does not cup his boy's wet cheeks in his hands and say, "You shall die, my son, and never be remembered. The little salamander you were frightened of at first and grew to love and buried in the garden. The long walk to school your legs learned. What shape our daily life, our short love gave you. The meaning of your noisy, harmless games. Every small sensation that went to make your eager and persistent gazing will be gone. Not simply the butterflies you fancied or the bodies you yearned to see uncovered. Look, there they are, the inner thighs, the nipples, boobs. Or what we all might have finally gained from the toys you treasured, the dreams you peopled, but especially your scarcely budded eyes and that rich and gentle quality of consciousness, which I hoped one day would have been uniquely yours, like the most subtle of flavors, the skin, the juice, the sweet pulp of a fine fruit. Well, son, your possibilities, as unrealized as the erections of your penis, in a moment, soon, will be ground out like a burnt wet butt beneath a callous boot and disappear in the dirt. Only our numbers will be remembered. Not that you or I died, but that there were so many of us. And that we were orderly, quiet, dignified, brave. On the other side of the mound, where two young women and the grandmother are going now, the dead have placed themselves in neat rows across an acre square grave. The next victims clamber awkwardly to the top of the pile, where they'll be shot by a young man with a submachine gun and a cigarette. Some of the dead have not yet died. They tremble their heads and elevate their arms, and their pardons are begged as they're stepped on. However, the wounded worry only that the earth will cover their open eyes. They want to be shot again. But the bullets bring down only those above them, and for a few, the weight is eventually so great it crushes their chests. Sometimes a foot slips on the blood-wet bodies, and a fat woman slides face forward down the stack when she is hit. Climbing up, there are quiet words to the wounded and an occasional caress. From the gunman's end, of course, the mound looks like a field full of false hair. Millions die, eventually, in all ways. Millions. What songs, what paintings, poems, arts of playing were also buried with them, and in what number? Who knows what inventions, notions, new discoveries were interred, burned, drowned? What pleasures for us all bled to death on the ice of a Finnish lake? What fine loaves, both baked and eaten, acres of cake? What rich emotions we might later share? How many hours of love were lost like sand down a glass through even the tiniest shrapnel puncture? Of course, one must count the loss of a lot of mean and silly carking, too. Thousands of thieves, murderers, Shylocks, con men, homos, hobos, wastrels, peevish clerks, loan sharks, drunkards, hopheads, Don Juans, pipsqueaks, debtors, premature ejaculators, epileptics, fibbers, fanatics, friggers, bullies, cripples, fancy ladies got their just deserts and were hacked apart or poisoned, driven mad or raped, and even sabered, or simply stood in a field and starved like wheat without water. And we shall never know how many callow effusions we were spared by a cut throat, how many slanderous tongues were severed, what sentimental love songs were choked off as though in mid-rope, mid-note by the rope, the number of the statues of Jesus, Mary, or the Pope, whose making was prevented by an opportune blindness or the breaking of the right bones. What canvases depicting mill wheels in moonlight, cattle at dawn, children and dogs lay unexecuted on their easels because of the gas. Talent thrown out as if it were the random pissing of paint into a bedpan. So that overall, and on sober balance, there could have been a decided gain. Yet there is always the troublesome, the cowardly midnight thought that a Milton might have been rendered mute and inglorious by an errant bullet through the womb, that some infant who is a precocious young man might conceive a Sistine ceiling for the world and humble us all with his genius as he made us proud of our common humanity. Well, there's always the fear that this not-yet youth has been halved like a peach, that Vermeer, Calderon, or Baudelaire, Frege or Fourier could conceivably, oh yes, just might possibly, have been gently carried to his death between a pair of gray-haired arms, which otherwise were no longer even strong enough to disturb a clear soup. I wrote The Tunnel out of the conviction that no race or nation is better than any other, and that no nation or race is worse, that the evil men do every day far outweighs the good, the goods being great art and profound knowledge scientifically obtained. The poet who has been my unwitting companion in this enterprise, Rainer Maria Rilke, similarly wondered, as his own career grew to a close, whether mankind had justified its reign of terror with some offsetting achievements. He thought about the grandeur of cathedrals, but really, was it enough? I quote from my translation of the Seventh Elegy. Wasn't it miraculous? O marvel, angel, that we did it! We, O great one, extol our achievements. My breath is too short for such praise. Because after all, we haven't failed to make use of our sphere, ours, these generous spaces. How frightfully vast they must be not to have overflowed with our feelings even after these thousands of years. But one tower was great, wasn't it? Oh, angel, it was, even compared to you. Chart was great, and music rose even higher, flew far beyond us. Even a woman in love, alone at night by her window, didn't she reach your knee? That but one tower was great, wasn't it? That plaintive, despairing but, as if anything played or painted or built or composed or inscribed, or a little love honest for a change and felt by another, could weigh as much as a sigh in the balance against Dubnose Pit and its corpse-high pile, or any massacre, even if it is that of fish in a poisoned lake. I have taught philosophy in one of other of its many modes for 50 years, Plato, my honey, in every one of them. Yet many of those years had to pass before I began to realize that evil actually was ignorance, as he and Socrates had so passionately taught, that most beliefs were bunkum, and that the removal of bad belief was as important to a mind as a cancer's excision was to the body it imperiled. To have a head full of nonsense is far worse than having a nose full of flu. And when I see the joggers at their numbing runs, I wonder if they ever exercise their heads or understand what the diet of their mind does to their consciousness, their character, to the body they pray to, the salvation they seek. Yet I had to admit, wondrous as he often was, that D.H. Lawrence was a fascist chowderhead, Eliot an anti-Semitic snob, Yeats fatuous, Blake mad, Frost a pious fake, Rilke, yes, even he, wrong more often than not, and that even Henry James, well, might have made a misstep once, alighting from a carriage. But there it was again, that but, that yet. Yet Henry was great, surely, if anyone was. How did the artist escape the presumably crippling effects of his intellectual idiocies? Here, I had activity number 6 to help me. It was theorizing, not about truth, about error. Skepticism was my rod, my staff, my exercise, and from fixes, my escape. Quote, what is critical to the artist is not the fact that he has many motives, let us hope so, or that their presence should never be felt in his canvases or found in the narrative nature of his novels or heard amid the tumult of his dissonances. In the first place, our other aims won't lend their assistance without reward, and they will want, as we say, a piece of the action. No, the question is, which of our intentions will be allowed to rule and regulate and direct the others? That is what is critical. It is a matter of the politics of desire, or as Plato put it when he asked this question of the moral agent, what faculty of the soul is in control of the will? Quote, I believe, I use this word here with the greatest irony, I believe that the artist's fundamental loyalty must be to form and his energy employed in the activity of making. Every other diddly desire can find expression. Every crackpot idea or local obsession, every bias and graciousness and mark of malice may have an hour, but it must never be allowed to carry the day. If, of course, one wants to be a publicist for something, if you believe you are a philosopher first and Nietzsche second, if you think the gift of prophecy has been given you, then by all means, write your bad poems, your insufferable fictions. Enjoy the fame that easy ideas often offer. Ride the flatulent winds of change. Fly like the latest fad to the nearest dead tree. But do not try to count the seasons of your oblivion. Life may be a grim and grisly business, but the poet's task and challenge remains unchanged. Rilke wrote, tell us, poet, what do you do? I praise. But the dreadful, the monstrous in their ways, how do you stand them, suffer it all? I praise. But anonymous, featureless days, how, poet, can you ask them to call? I praise. What chance have you, in so many forms, under each mask, to speak a true phrase? I praise. And at the calm, as well as the crazed, know you, like star and storm? Because I praise. Celebrating is the 7th preoccupation then, because to write well about anything, and it might be mayhem, is to love at least the language that you are attaching to it, and therefore to give it glory. This result can be disconcerting, and there are readers, writers, critics, who feel that such attention as the artist often gives to the awful is itself awful. Even those anonymous, featureless days should be left where they lie, like idle waste, idly discarded, unphrased. I'm sometimes accused of retreating into language, of being a good writer on paper, and it's certainly where I often send my characters, villains or whores, most of them, into a world of words. Is there happiness, fulfillment, to be had from the canvas, the stone, in the score, on the page? Nope, I wrote. Quote, so even if you hope to find some lasting security inside language and believe that your powers are at their peak there, if nowhere else, despair and disappointment will dog you still, for neither you nor your weakness nor the world and its villains will have been vanquished just because now it is in syllables and sentences where they hide. Since, oddly enough, while you can confront and denounce a colleague or a spouse, run from an angry dog, or jump bail and flee your country, you can't argue with an image. Inasmuch as a badly made sentence is a judgment pronounced upon its perpetrator, and even one poor paragraph indelibly stains the soul. The unpleasant consequence of every such botch is that your life, as you register your writing, looks back at you as from a dirty mirror, and there you perceive a record of ineptitude, compromise, and failure. A translating allowed me to get close to poetry in a way my own feeble efforts would never permit. And yes, when I had finished a poem of Rilke's, I would sometimes imagine I had written it, and that his sounds were mine, as in English they had to be, that he was once more alive in me, in all of us who could hear him, say him, be him. I concluded my book reading Rilke with this paragraph and one poem, as I shall conclude this reading with these remarks. Quote, the poem is thus a paradox. It is made of air. It vanishes as the things it speaks about vanish. It's made of music, like us, the most fleeting of all. Yet it is also made of meaning that's as immortal gets on our mortal earth. Because the poem will return, will begin again as spring returns. It can be said again, sung again, is our only answered prayer. The poem can be carried about more easily than a purse, and I don't have to wait when I want it for a violinist to get in key. It can come immediately to mind, to my mind, because it is my poem as much as it is yours, because like a song, it can be sung in many places at once and danced as well, because the poem becomes a condition of the body. It enlivens our bones, and they dance the Orange. They dance the Hardy, the Hopkins, the Valerie, the Yeats. Because the poem is a state of the soul, too, the soul we once had, and these states change as all else does, and these states mingle and conflict and grow weak or strong, and even if these verbalized moments of consciousness suggest things which are unjust or untrue when mistaken for statements, when rightly written, they are real. They themselves are as absolutely as we achieve the real in this unrealized life. Are with a vengeance. Because, oddly enough, though what has been celebrated is over, and one's own life, the life of the celebrant, may be over, the celebration is not over. The celebration goes on. The poem is The Death of the Poet by Rilke. He lay. His pillow-propped face could only stare with pale refusal at the quiet coverlet, now that the world and all his knowledge of it, stripped from his senses to leave them bare, had fallen back to an indifferent year. Those who had seen him living could not know how completely one he was with all that flowed. For these deep valleys, each meadowed place, these streaming waters were his face. Oh, his face embraced this vast expanse which seeks him still and woos him yet. Now his last mask, squeamishly dying there, tender and open, has no more resistance than a fruit's flesh spoiling in the air. Thank you very much. Thank you.
That concludes the reading for this event. Next up is the conversation.
Hello again. That was really wonderful. Thank you. I was thinking of a lot of things when you were reading. One is the passage you read from Oman Sutter's Luck. I love that passage so much. And I want to talk to you a little bit, ask you some questions about that in a moment. But I was also thinking how you talked about how evil is ignorance. I think I was watching television today for about an hour, which is not something I generally do, and was also trying to imagine what it would be like to spend your life watching about 6 hours a day of television, say. And you spoke about our heads are full of nonsense, and what's happening in the United States at this. I mean, just how filled our heads are with so much garbage, really.
Yes, I think that's. I always thought that that's what would happen to everything in the world. You know, it would end up at some sort of knick-knack, or garbage, or refuse of some sort, a big midden pile. I think that's what Joyce envisioned. And that's where the little bird scratches the secret of life out of the midden. Of course, we can't read it, never do. But I think that it is essential, apparently, to powers that be to maintain their authority by corrupting the public.
Yeah.
And keeping, you know, doing one thing, filling their heads full of blather, but the other constantly keep them entertained.
Right.
So that they won't realize what they're doing.
Yeah. Yeah, in another interview you gave, you talked about how Americans are so little interested in reality, despite our desire for realism in both our film and television and these novels, that you know, they always want realism. And it's so interesting how so little realistic realism is. And I've always thought that, and yet my students walk in. Sorry, that better? And that's what they want. I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit.
Well, there's a whole tradition, you know, and as you know, certainly, in literature of realism.
Yeah.
And if you look at that so-called realistic novel as it came to us, in which it was supposed to describe life, it did so in a way that seemed to me quite unreal. In the first place, there was an omnipotent narrator, and this narrator knew everything, presumably, and that life went on in a series of meaningful stages, and that it was built like a ladder, and at the end was the Rotary Club or something. And you know, everything, and it was clear who was bad, and it was clear who was good. This is just, if this is realism, this is a complete daydream. And so when I wrote The Tunnel, though I'm in print as being an anti-realist, I mean anti-that realism, the realism of the bourgeois novel, really. And the bourgeois did one good thing. They invented comfort. I'm all for that. But in order to be comfortable, we have to secure, you know, our anxieties. All of this spate of novels, some of which are, of course, quite great, that pretend or appear to be just like life. I threw in The Tunnel a whole scene that repeats itself, because Gertrude told me. Things repeat. But not quite ever the same. And filled it full of confusion and lies and darkness and insecurity. And people said, oh, this is just this anti-realist book. And I thought, no, I'm... The book is supposed to be, The Tunnel was supposed to be written by a historian who was writing an anti-history in this collection of rants and raves. But that's another problem with history. It always cleans up the situation. The crime scene gets messed up with immediately, and a nice, clear case is made. And there aren't any, it seems to me, or very few. There have to be a few, just in a chance world, there would be some.
Yeah, that's right. I think I've never trusted history because of my own personal history. And
oh, yes. You've been in the middle and associated with lies and cover-ups of a monumental sort.
Yeah, that's right, because the Armenian Genocide has always been something denied, and then the official history wrote it out. So I was always, but I grew up in America, but still very suspicious of American history as well, because of the way the genocide here was completely erased of indigenous people. But sort of in The Tunnel, though, I'm curious, because it did take you a long time, 26 or 27 years to write. And when I think of my own books, I think of the influences, the books that sort of went into them. I can remember them. And when you spend that much time in a book, that must be either then many more books, or I'm just curious what it's like to spend so much time with Kohler in particular. Yeah.
Well, I think it's a problem, though. It was exaggerated in my case, but it's a problem that confronts any writer of fiction.
Yeah.
Because you can't write a fiction. Even a bad novel takes several years. And so you have to be the same narrator from beginning to end. Meanwhile, you may be changing radically. And the problem is constantly keeping the same narrative nature as you're going from the... You have to be the same author who began the book, who closes the book. Whereas the person that you are is, you hope, changing. And what I had to do was constantly go back to the beginning and start over in order to try to make the book I would be writing now. And then the problem also was that this was a disagreeable book. So I would use that book as an obstacle book. I always have an obstacle book, the book I'm supposed to be writing. But in order not to write it, I write several others. And that's how I get books done. That's the only way. And sometimes there are several obstacle books and only one book that isn't an obstacle, and you probably shouldn't publish it.
I was wondering. I was thinking both in The Tunnel and then in Omen Setter's Luck, and part of the piece you read, Was I Born for this? Mm-hmm. And Kohler says in The Tunnel, what do we protest that we die alive? And in this sort of loneliness and bitterness in both of those characters. And then for me, the raging that both of those characters do. Ferber in Omen Setter's Luck, I think it's towards the end, says, there's this beautiful sentence where he says, why did you make us the saddest animals? It's such a beautiful moment in that book, if you haven't read it yet, because you really arrive there as the reader. And I think that's happening in all of your fiction in a way. Why have you made us the saddest animal? Sort of beneath that rage is this incredible surprise and sadness that this is what we have. I don't know if you have anything to say about that. But.
Well, my wife and I read the papers every morning and we go, ah! you know, what are you doing now? I'm writing a new novel, and one of the things that's involved in it is that I have a character who is creating the Inhumanity Museum. I'm asking the reader at a certain point to contribute by just going to the paper at any time. And you will find without moving an inch, some horrible story of incomprehensible brutality, stupidity, acrimony, hatred, whatever. And so it renews itself until you become, of course, just simply worn out. And your anger is sort of a gesture, which is also sad. I do find, and it's a very dangerous moment, and if you have any courage at all, you leave your desk. But when you discover that you have to generate your anger over something that is, in fact, anger-making, and you ought to be mad, but you can't be mad anymore, you're just worn out, so you find yourself trying to push your rhetoric up so it will get you mad, and of course it's going to be terrible stuff.
It is interesting to me, though, how, particularly in the tunnel, spending a lot of time with someone like Kohler, this monster, I think you've called him, and sort of looking at, and I think you do this a lot in your work, the vulgar and the vicious and the detritus, and making something beautiful from it as well, because the texts are beautiful, your sentences are beautiful. That must be conscious on your part to do that. I know you've written about that in your essays as well.
Well, you do it.
Yes, I do.
So you're convicted as well. Well, I think that it's an issue.
True.
It's an important issue.
Yeah.
Aesthetically, as well as just the problem of... because there are many who feel that that is somehow a betrayal of what one ought to be feeling. But, of course... that's what, in one way, art has always done. I mean, if I'm reading, say, Beckett, I don't come away having read Beckett ready to get into the garbage can or something. I'm uplifted as I see a writer pushing away suicide, in fact, by his own work, struggling always over and over to get something said, and with nothing to say and all the rest of it. But the torment of that is done so beautifully, so right, it gives to that great eloquence. And that's what rituals often do. I mean, when one is bereft, for instance, one may just scream, howl, and roll on the floor in rage or despair or something, but in the right ritual, that despair can be given structure and beauty and meaning, which it hasn't much when it's just a howl. And I think that that's one of the things that one is hoping to try to do, at any rate. There's another element. I used to talk with Jack Hawks about this, because Hawks also dwelt in his wonderful novels on the horrible and the sexually obscene and so on. And he would write about it. There's a scene in The Lime Twig where... a woman gets beaten with a wet newspaper. It is absolutely, I've read it aloud to audiences, it's just stunning, you know. And it is so beautiful. But does that make it, in a sense, less horrible? No, it makes it a monument to horror. And you know what's going on in a way that you never would otherwise. But you are saying, at least I'm just saying, I can hardly get through the thing because it's done so well. You just think, well, what the hell? You can't write like that. You know. He could write sentences that are so marvelous. I think, one of the elements. Another is that the same things are happening. The disasters, the nastiness, the deaths, all the pain that's inflicted upon people. And it is written about beautifully by writers in totally different ways. And that, I think, is a very important lesson about the nature of the reality that we have, too. When you get someone writing about tragic events, the approaches, the writers, have different values, different points of view, different styles, and different beauties, but there they are, beautiful.
Different obsessions, too,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. No, I think you're right, and you've written, I mean, I have that same idea, and you've that art needs to see everything and include both the glories and the horror of what it means to be human. And your work does do that in this amazing way. I also was thinking about in your fiction and also in the essays, the sexual and the sensual in your work. And I read a number of interviews you'd given, and no one, it didn't seem like anyone asked you, and yet there are a lot of cocks and cons going on,
yeah,
in the work, and it's ribald, it's the body. I mean, your language, and I know you've written about this too, but it sits in your mouth. When I read your work, my mouth does move because it is, I think you do what you set out to do in this way of making the word flesh, and the way you list as well. And I just want to know if you can talk about that. I know on Being Blue, this beautiful book of yours, you say, we always plate our sexual subjects first. It is the original reason why we read, the only reason why we write. Mm-hmm. And I love that. I wonder if you can talk about that.